Imagine you're building three complex video games all at once.
Oh, wow. Three at the same time.
Yeah, three games. And your AI agents are flawlessly writing thousands of lines of code. I mean, it feels like absolute magic.
Right, because the logic just compiles perfectly.
Exactly. The mechanics work, and you haven't had to manually type a single algorithm. But then you ask that same incredibly powerful AI to write like a single line of human dialogue.
Oh, I can see where this is going.
And the result is so wildly embarrassing, it literally makes your toes curl. So, for today's deep dive, we're looking at a game developer who hit exactly this wall.
What's fascinating here is the collision of disciplines, right?
Right.
Because code is structural.
Right.
If a piece of logic is wrong, the compiler throws an error and the game just crashes. The failure is immediate, it's mathematical, and it's totally objective.
Yeah, the machine tells you you're wrong.
Exactly. But story. For a highly technical, STEM-focused creator, storytelling usually looks like this unapproachable dark art.
Right, and he learned very quickly that AI cannot just, fake that dark art. To give you, the listener, a sense of the stakes here, I have to share the exact line of AI-generated dialogue that caused this developer to completely rethink his process.
Oh, please do. Lay it on me.
Okay, so two characters are standing in a ruined landscape, and the AI generates this. As the last guardian of the city, you of course know that the Great War 300 years ago took everything from us.
Oof. Yeah, that sentence is practically a museum exhibit of bad writing.
It really is. The author actually had a perfect analogy for it. He realized this isn't writing. It's like splitting a Wikipedia entry in half and having two people read it aloud to each other.
That is so accurate. It's the classic, as you know, Bob, exposition dump. You have two characters solemnly stating historical facts out loud that they both already know.
Just entirely for the benefit of the unseen audience.
Right. And it stacks the emotions with these heavy-handed adjectives, leaves absolutely zero subtext for the player to unpack, and it basically treats human conversation like a crude data transfer.
So, if AI can write perfect code but fails at basic human dialogue, how does a non-writer solve the story problem? Well, they treat creativity as a research project.
Which forces a really profound realization. You can't just outsource creativity to an AI without understanding the mechanics of creativity yourself. You have to know what good looks like to prompt the machine.
Exactly. So he deployed his AI specifically, Opus 4.8, across eight simultaneous research streams.
Eight. That's serious dedication.
I know, right? He chewed through heavy craft theory from people like Robert McKee, Christopher Vogler, Brandon Sanderson, K.M. Weiland.
All the heavy hitters.
Yeah. And he had it tear apart the narrative beats of massive gacha games. And crucially, he even analyzed famously failed story arcs.
To figure out where the tracks gave out. And that research immediately shattered how most beginners approach narrative, starting with the very foundation, the concept of theme.
Okay, let's unpack this because the author realized beginners use single theme words. Like they sit down and say, I'm making a game about freedom, or I'm making a game about loneliness.
Which is just a topic, right? It's not a theme. A theme has to be a full sentence, it has to be a controlling idea.
So instead of just freedom, it would be something like, freedom is won only when you trust your own strength enough to break the system controlling you.
Exactly. That full sentence becomes the blueprint. And to test if your theme is actually structural, you apply this thing craft theorists call the acid test.
Ooh, the acid test.
It's brutal, but it's so necessary. You take your story and you just completely flip the ending. You let your protagonist fail.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And if your story still functions perfectly fine, your theme was never a structural spine. It was just decorative frosting.
Oh, wait, is that really that easy to spot? Because the author himself failed this at first.
Oh, totally.
He had this fuzzy idea for a game about loneliness, and it completely shattered on contact with the acid test because he realized whether his main character was lonely or like surrounded by friends, it made literally zero difference to how they defuse the bomb in the third act.
Right, the loneliness wasn't driving the plot. It was just a moody filter he slapped over the action.
Yeah, the protagonist's loneliness didn't affect the outcome.
But once you establish a true load-bearing theme, you have to populate that world with characters who actually feel human. And again, the author found a rigid framework for this from K.M. Weiland. The chain of wound, lie, want, and need.
Okay, wait, hold on. Let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Is a wound just a tragic backstory? Because I feel like every edgy video game protagonist has a sad childhood, right?
Oh, yeah, that is the exact trap most writers fall into. A wound isn't just a sad thing that happened, it's an active psychological engine.
Right.
It's cause and effect. The wound is a specific trauma that forces the character to develop a false belief about how the world works. And that's the lie.
So they use that lie as a shield.
Exactly. Because they believe the lie, they chase a tangible, misguided goal, which is their want.
Okay, so the backstory is actively driving their current behavior.
Yes. And to actually resolve the story, they have to drop that shield. They have to accept the hard truth they've been running from, which is the need.
It's a mechanical engine for character growth. And to make sure you don't fall back into that Wikipedia-style writing when describing these characters, the author found a brilliant rule for the one-line trait.
Oh, I love this rule.
Right. You use behaviors, never adjectives. Saying someone is brave is totally useless, but saying she's the type who laughs loudest at a funeral, instantly a real person steps off the page.
Like, behavior implies history. It shows that wound, lie, want, need, chain without spelling it out.
So we have a character who feels alive on paper, but how do you make a player actually want to spend real money on them?
Ah, the million-dollar question.
Here's where it gets really interesting. You have to master a very specific psychological hook called gapmo, and the author admitted he originally got this totally backwards.
Yeah.
He thought it just meant welding two contrasting labels together, like she's an aloof assassin but secretly a glutton.
Right, you just staple two contrasting quirks together and expect the player to open their wallet. But if you do that, the player spots the seam instantly.
It feels manufactured.
Exactly. Real gapmo is much deeper. It's a high recognition surface trait multiplied by a contradictory inner core. But, and this is the absolute crux of it, both of those things must be entirely rooted in the character's wound.
If the contrast isn't explainable by the wound, it just falls apart. The author built a custom example for his AI to demonstrate this, and it's so good. The character's name is Suji.
Right, the tear broker.
Yeah. Her trait is, she's the type who can price your tears to market rate in 3 seconds, but hasn't cried herself in 3 years.
Which perfectly sets up that contrast. The surface trait is extreme, cold calculation.
And the inner core is emotional paralysis. But why is she like that? Because her trusted mentor took the only tear she ever shed and sold it for a promotion.
It's brilliant. The wound perfectly welds that cold, monetized surface to the emotionally mute core. You can't see the joints.
It's psychological inevitability. But, you know, having these incredible characters brings us to a massive trap for creators, the disease of world-building procrastination.
Oh, man, this is everywhere.
It really is. It's when your notes on, like, 8,000-year chronologies and fictional currency systems completely outweigh your actual script.
Because world-building carries no risk. You can invent pantheons of gods all day, but the second you write a scene of dialogue, you expose the fact that you might not actually be able to write.
Exactly. So the cure the author found using AI is this dead simple test. For every piece of lore, you ask, does this drive a character's decision?
Does it create a plot obstacle?
Right. Or does it explain a visible consequence for the player? If no, you're denied permission to build it. Story first, world second.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it aligns perfectly with Brandon Sanderson's Law of Magic. Sanderson says that limitations are far more interesting than powers.
Oh, absolutely. Omnipotent magic is just boring.
It's narrative poison because it solves everything instantly. Hmm. But a magic system that cures any fabled disease, but say shaves a year off your own life every time you use it.
That creates instant narrative tension. So building the world efficiently is one thing. But how do these massive game studios keep a narrative engine running indefinitely? I mean, these games go on for years without the story collapsing under its own weight.
Yeah, that's the architecture of the never-ending story. The author researched Kinoko Nasu, the writer for Fate Grand Order, to figure this out. And Nasu's approach is to nail the endpoint on day one.
So you don't just write endlessly.
No, you declare there are exactly 7 chapters. You build the skeleton first so both you and the players know exactly where the finish line is.
And to manage all the mysteries inside that skeleton, the author brought up the foreshadowing ledger.
Yes, a strictly controlled document.
Yeah, it tracks exactly which mystery hole is dug in which chapter, and crucially, when it will be filled. Because digging holes is fun, but the ledger does the heavy lifting.
Writers love the dopamine hit of dropping a cryptic hint. But the ledger forces a mathematical reality. If you open a box in chapter one, you have to pre-schedule when you're closing it.
And this is exactly what Honkai Star Rail got criticized for during their Amphorious arc. They just dug holes faster than they could fill them, and it exhausted the players.
You can't just pile on narrative debt like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, diving into these structural mechanics led the author to shatter a massive regional stereotype in the gacha community.
Oh, yeah. He assumed, like I think a lot of people do, that Chinese gacha games were fundamentally world first and Japanese games were character first.
Right, that it was this cultural design philosophy.
But the truth is totally different. Kai Haiyu from Maiho, the studio behind Genshin and Star Rail, revealed at GDC 2021 that they are strictly 100% character first.
Which is wild when you look at how massive Genshin's open world is.
Well,
but the world is just cinematic packaging for the characters.
Exactly. The genuinely world-first Chinese studios are places like Hypergriff with Arknights or Blue Pock with Reverse, 1999. And over in Korea, Project Moon with Limbus Company fits that world-first mold too.
The synthesis here is really important. Narrative emphasis and presentation form are completely independent axes.
Yeah.
They have absolutely nothing to do with nationality.
And once you realize that, all these confusing game design choices just instantly click into place. So knowing the structure is crucial. But what actually keeps players coming back is how the story makes them feel.
Emotions are the real retention metric.
So what does this all mean? It transitions us into emotional manipulation, specifically the knife, which is the author's term for how to make a player cry.
And there are strict rules for this. The main rule of the knife is you must make the audience genuinely love the character before you have the right to take them away.
He cited the opening 4 minutes of Pixar's Up for this, right?
Yes. That sequence destroys you, not because it's sad, but because it spends the time meticulously making you fall in love with Carl and Ellie's daily life first.
But there are anti-patterns here, ways you can totally botch the knife.
Oh, definitely. There are three big failures. First is misery mongering, which is just piling on suffering before you've earned the player's love.
Like trauma for the sake of trauma.
Right. The second is instrumental death. That's when you kill a character off purely as a prop just to make the main protagonist sad.
They aren't a real person, just an emotional tool.
Exactly. And the third, and this is very specific to gacha games, is the pull paradox.
Oh, this one is brutal. Imagine you spend real-world money and tons of emotion to finally pull a character from the gacha system, and then the writers just knife that character in the very next update.
It's a razor's edge. You're trying to move the player, but you end up stabbing them in the back. You break their trust in the game's economy.
Speaking of breaking trust, we have to talk about the mystery box and the danger of the camera protagonist.
Right, the iron law of the mystery box, which Lost famously violated, is you never open a loop, you can't close yourself.
But the camera protagonist is when the main character is just this passive information relay. They just trail the plot with zero agency. Wuthering Waves really suffered from this in their 1.0 launch.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, though, that kind of flaw isn't fatal if studios are willing to iterate. Wuthering Waves actively fixed that and won audiences back by their 2.0 Reniseta region.
And Zenless Zone Zero fixed its heavily criticized TV mode pretty quickly, too.
Exactly. A bad first impression burns future versions, sure, but it is recoverable.
So the author has isolated all these intricate rules of storytelling, but the next step wasn't just to memorize them. He built an AI coach that actually forces you to use them.
The skill coach?
Yeah. It's called Game Script Creation. It's an open source skill in his repo with, like, 12 docs and 9 templates, but crucially, and he is very firm about this, it is not a one-click generator.
Because if you just click generate, you get that exact same cringe dialogue from the beginning of our deep dive.
Right. So instead, it asks you to write 3 sentences describing a person getting bad news. And from that tiny sample, it reveals your true skill level.
It acts as a sparring partner. It offers scaffolding rather than just doing the work for you.
And this leads to the most profound realization of the whole source material. Historically, I can't write was just the end of the road.
Right, you either spent years taking classes or you just gave up.
But now, AI compresses an entire library of craft into an on-call coach.
The bottleneck has fundamentally shifted. It is no longer, can you execute? It is now, do you have the taste to judge?
Exactly.
AI still writes cringe dialogue by default, but it's no longer a problem if the human directing it knows how to spot the lack of subtext and fix it.
And that brings us to a final, really provocative thought for you to mull over. The author realized that AI's cringe isn't a tech problem at all, it's a human judgment problem.
Oh.
AI can build the scaffolding so you can reach heights you never thought possible, but you still have to decide what the building looks like. So as AI removes the barrier of execution in almost every creative field, how much time are you spending actually training your taste? Because in a world where everyone has an AI co-writer, your taste is the only thing that actually makes the story yours.